and welcome to the Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Maria Armudian. In this hour, since 2020, Azerbaijan has attacked the Armenian people of Nagorno-Karabakh, or Artsakh, as it's known to Armenians. And in September 2023, it ethnically cleansed them from their historic homelands. What legal actions have been taken against Azerbaijan at the International Criminal Court and the International Court of Justice, and what might the consequences of these legal actions be? Doug Becker explores.
I'm Doug Becker. In September 2023, Azerbaijan launched military operations against the Armenian-dominated region of Nagorno-Karabakh, or what Armenians call Artsakh. This was a continuation of the conflict that reignited in 2020. The region, which has historic Armenian ties and was populated largely by Armenians, but is legally a part of Azerbaijan, was ethnically cleansed of these Armenians. In the interim, Armenia filed a case against Azerbaijan, accusing them of violating the UN's anti-discrimination treaty, and also have requested investigations of allegations of genocide. And in the background, are ongoing negotiations between the Armenian government and Azerbaijan to negotiate a potential final status of the region, particularly in light of the controversial UN decision to name Azerbaijan as the host of the next climate change meetings in late 2024. So on today's show, we will explore these issues: Armenia's case against Azerbaijan, what this means for regional security, and largely what it means for international legal responses to this type of violence. Our panel today is Tamara Voskanian. She is a co-founder of the Center for Truth and Justice. This is a nonprofit organization that documents atrocities and uses evidence to bring perpetrators to justice. Last month, she represented the CFTJ at the UN Committee Against Torture. Talin Hitik is an international human rights advocate. She focuses on seeking accountability for war crimes and human rights violations. She's also worked as a legal officer at The Hague on private international law and the Permanent Court of Arbitration, and has served at the Ministry of Justice of Armenia, managing European Court of Human Rights litigation. She was also professor of international human rights and humanitarian law at the American University of Armenia and Yerevan State University, and most recently was an academic affiliate at the University of Michigan Law School. And Steve Swerbo is associate professor of the practice of human rights in the Department of Political Science and International Relations at the University of Southern California. He writes extensively as a human rights monitor for Human Rights Watch in both the Central Asian and Caucasus regions. Thank you all very much for joining us. Tamara Voskanian, I'm going to start with you, first of all, to remind our listeners of the background to this conflict. This has obviously been a conflict that's been ongoing, especially the modern manifestation for the last few decades, and particularly salient the last 4 years or so. So, you know, what is the background to this conflict?
Thanks, Doug. The background is that in September 2020, Azerbaijan launched an offensive into Artsakh, as you mentioned earlier at the beginning of the show, and there was a war that lasted for 44 days, during which a very large portion of the Artsakh population was basically expelled or forced to leave their homelands, and there were thousands of deaths. All those people ended up in Armenia, all those people that left Artsakh, and Center for Truth and Justice was born to interview those victims and sort of document their stories. And then in May 2021, the Azerbaijani armed forces initiated another unlawful military aggression into Armenia proper. And since then, it's been illegally occupying a couple of hundred of square kilometers of Armenian sovereign territory in various portions of Armenia. And in order to do this, they've ethnically cleansed the villages and areas where those people were living. So, although the active war ended in November 2020 in Artsakh, there have been problems ever since. So basically, although I think the world sort of considers that the war is over, for Armenia, the war is not really over, because Azerbaijan continues to want more and more of Armenian land. And unfortunately, they've been successful in getting that in our history, not just recent history, of course, Artsakh, but also Nakhichevan. And now they are laying claim to a lot of portions of Armenia proper.
There's two separate issues here, sort of separate issues that I know they're interconnected. This area, Nagorno-Karabakh, Artsakh, which is legally a part of Azerbaijan, but has traditionally, historically been Armenian. There's the violence in those areas, but also Armenia laying claim to and attacking areas that are actually legally recognized as a part of Armenia as well. Is that correct?
That's correct. Yeah, Azerbaijan. I think you meant to say Azerbaijan, but yes, correct.
Well, my apologies. So Azerbaijan's been attacked. So because that's always complicated, this issue about, you know, is this attack on Armenia? It's definitely an attack against Armenians, but it's also an attack against Armenia.
Yes, correct.
Okay. Telling Hitik, excuse me, there are different legal instruments that Armenia has used to try to find legal redress on these questions. The International Criminal Court, as well as the International Court of Justice. First of all, what's the difference between these two and what kinds of issues get raised in the different courts?
Thank you so much, Doug, for the question. And thanks for having me. I'm going to be a pedantic lawyer for a second. I'm a lawyer by trade, and my field is public international law. And I have to just sort of point out something extremely important, which is you've now repeated twice that Nagorno-Karabakh is legally a part of Azerbaijan. I take issue with this. Nagorno-Karabakh is not legally a part of Azerbaijan and never has been. And I know that probably sometime later in the discussion, we will get to some discussion about the current ongoing peace negotiation between Armenia and Azerbaijan, which is being sort of brokered by the leadership of the United States and in some cases France, in some cases Russia. And in those discussions, we finally got to a point where we are using the Almaty protocols, which the Almaty protocols established the Commonwealth of Independent States at the end of the Soviet Union. And I bring this up just to point out that if we are going to use the Almaty protocols to delineate the border between Armenia and Azerbaijan, we will also have to be intellectually honest about the fact that those Almaty protocols also recognize the Nagorno-Karabakh Republic. So the Nagorno-Karabakh Republic was established in line with the Soviet Constitution. And a legal referendum was held that was in line with the Soviet Constitution, and a referendum for independence with a vast majority of the population of Nagorno-Karabakh was held in December 1991. That is legally binding. And unfortunately, because of all the confusion at the time, because of the Almaty protocols creating the Commonwealth of Independent States, and because of the weakness of these new republics, we didn't set the record and we didn't accurately. We, meaning the international community, frankly, I don't even mean American Armenians or Armenians as a whole. The international community didn't get it right. And now, about three decades later, we're calling it legally, internationally recognized as Azerbaijan. Well, actually, we just kind of let it go that Nagorno-Karabakh Republic had a legally binding referendum of independence. So I just want to point that out, because let's stop saying that Nagorno-Karabakh is legally recognized as Azerbaijan. It's not.
You know, and just to follow it up to clarify that, what you're saying is that there was this agreement that was never implemented that would have recognized Nagorno-Karabakh as an independent state, correct?
I'm saying that Nagorno-Karabakh went through the legal process of becoming an independent state in line with the law at the time, which was mm-hmm. the Soviet Constitution. Mm-hmm. And then the Almaty protocols came into force, which was basically the signing of the agreement to become a Commonwealth of Independent States. That confused the situation of whether or not Nagorno-Karabakh was an independent country, because Nagorno-Karabakh wasn't at the table when they signed the Commonwealth of Independent States, although it should have been. In addition to that, directly following that, there were pogroms and mass killings of ethnic Armenians in Nagorno-Karabakh as a retaliation for this independence referendum vote. All of that sort of, now we're in, you know, we're talking about history, and all of that sort of got confused in history. And now we're at a point where we've let it go for 30 years. And now everyone thinks that Nagorno-Karabakh Republic is internationally recognized as Azerbaijan, which it is not.
I will acknowledge, I actually didn't know this history. So I'm, you know, one of the reasons why, you know, I love doing a show is I get a chance to, you know, get a chance to, you know, to learn this. To return back to that question then about the ICJ versus the ICC.
Yes, of course. Yeah.
What are the difference between the two, especially considering what confuses a lot of people is they're both literally in the same city, correct?
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. So the headquarters of international peace and justice is The Hague in the Netherlands. And that's why they're in the same city. There's lots and lots of international tribunals in The Hague dealing with different parts of international law. So the International Court of Justice is the principal judicial organ of the United Nations. It hears cases between states that are UN members, and it also hears advisory opinions on important issues of international law, which are most of the time ordered by the General Assembly of the United Nations. So that's a court that's basically the UN court or the world court, and it only hears cases that are one country versus another country. That is not the same thing as the International Criminal Court, which is it's sort of an independent international organ that has jurisdiction over international crimes. And rather than that being the ICJ is state versus state, and the ICC, first of all, only has jurisdiction over crimes that are in the founding statute, which is called the Rome Statute. So essentially, this is highly reductive, but essentially genocide, war crimes, and crimes against humanity, and sometimes the crime of aggression as well. And so those are the crimes over which the court has jurisdiction, and the court has a prosecutor, and it will find individual criminal responsibility for individuals who committed these crimes.
And I know that the ICC, when they choose to take up a case and open an investigation, there's three, the phrase they use is triggering mechanisms, right? That the Security Council can refer a case to the ICC, a state that has territorial jurisdiction can refer a case, or the prosecutor can take the case up really of his or her own initiative. So two questions. One, has the ICC opened up a formal investigation for war crimes in this case? And if so, who triggered it?
So the simple answer is no, not yet. The prosecutor has not opened a preliminary investigation for crimes committed, for the region in general. I mean, whether you call it Nagorno-Karabakh, Armenia, or Azerbaijan.
Okay, so the status of that is there's been a request that they open the investigation, that the prosecutor opens the investigation, but the prosecutor has not yet.
Yeah, correct? So there's been a request in the form of a communication, which I'll let Tamara cover.
So the communication that CFTJ filed was very recent. So I wouldn't, expect that an investigation would be open already, but the idea was to trigger the request for an investigation so that we make sure that the court's eyes are on what's happening. And we sort of point the court towards what we see is happening. CFTJ, as we've been gathering evidence from war survivors and witnesses for the past almost 4 years, is, sort of been on the ground fact investigation. So we're not necessarily saying, we know exactly what law has been violated, or we know, it's just we're asking you to take up this investigation as the court with this mandate into the acts committed or ordered by the leadership of Azerbaijan.
Okay, we're going to return to this and go into a bit more detail about this, but I want to bring Steve Swerdlow in. And actually, before I do, I'm going to remind us we're listening to Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Doug Becker. Our topic today are war crimes violations, accusations of human rights abuses in the conflict between Azerbaijan and Armenia, specifically in the area of Nagorno-Karabakh or Artsakh and areas around that. And our guests are Tamara Voskanian of the Center for Truth and Justice, Helene Kitik, who's worked as a professor of international law at American University of Armenia, Yerevan State University, and the University of Michigan Law School, and Steve Swerdlow of the University of Southern California. And Steve, I want to bring you in on this question. There is a formal complaint. I believe it was filed in 2021, right, about Azerbaijan's violations of the UN Treaty on Racial Discrimination, and specifically, my understanding is specifically issues like hate speech. Can you give us some details about that case?
Well, that's a very important case. I think it really illuminates how, Armenia, which has been confronted on the battlefield with such overwhelming force by the Azerbaijani military and mercenaries, and we saw, Human Rights Watch and other organizations and CFTJ documented the commission of egregious war crimes and crimes against humanity. And I think what was, in a way, inspiring was to see the Republic of Armenia using the courts, using these mechanisms to defend itself legally, to raise issues that had needed to be discussed for a long time. This policy of racial discrimination, we would say that this is Armenophobia, something that I personally witnessed and experienced numerous times when conducting research inside Azerbaijan, human rights missions, where one could easily detect in the early 2000s, but with really increasing frequency, the total embrace by President Ilham Aliyev of Azerbaijan of a state-sponsored ethnic discrimination of Armenians, a demonization in school textbooks, in official policies, in numerous statements on the media. And so what Armenia was raising when it filed this case at the International Court of Justice was to make a connection between the violence on the battlefield, the potential genocide, the war crimes, with, in some ways, the more pernicious and longstanding hatred that has unfortunately been so effective in mobilizing the populace of Azerbaijan to get behind this war. And so it's an interesting and innovative and important case. Of course, Azerbaijan filed counterclaims immediately, which I think, you know, mostly can be dispensed with as irrelevant. But at the heart of this case is an analysis of the president's statements about Armenians. And I can just, you know, preview some of them. My students at USC and I have been doing an analysis of this case, and some of the worst sorts of examples of Armenophobia that we hear from the president himself. He says, we hadn't known the scale of vandalism and barbarism of the Armenians. This completely subverted the whole ideological concept of the Armenians of being a civilized people. In later statements, he says, we have not only liberated our lands, but we have cleansed the region of these savage forces. I repeat that they are humiliated. The Armenians are humiliated now. Another official from Azerbaijan's representative to the Council of Europe, I believe, says that Armenia and the Armenian diaspora has long since been a cancerous tumor of Europe, which really conjures up parallels to the Rwandan genocide, Doug. That's what's so alarming about this. And then in later statements from as recent as March 2023, we hear the president saying that Armenians are, again, treacherous, ungrateful. And so the research that we're currently conducting is looking at these statements as dehumanizing language, but also in relation to what Talin and Tamara have mentioned about the ongoing peace negotiations, there's also a message that's coming out of Azerbaijan, which is basically saying, integrate or perish. Integrate into Azerbaijan, join our society, forcibly be assimilated, or perish. And that is, you know, I would say a related category of hate speech that we're witnessing now. And I think this case, which it hasn't been discussed on, reviewed on the merits, we've seen a lot of discussion of the provisional measures and motions and things as recently as a few weeks ago, but we haven't yet gotten to the merits of the case, and it will probably take a few more years to get this really important judgment out of the ICJ.
It sounds like you're talking about speech that frequently is used as a means, as a pathway to violence, to atrocity, even potentially to genocide. Tamara, I think you have some thoughts on this as well.
Thank you. I do. Steve, that I can't wait to see all the result of your work. I just am interested by the idea, and I know you already know this, but integrate or perish is almost like such a nice way to say it. You know, it's really like totally capitulate and humiliate yourself and everything. Because I was just thinking about how I was in Geneva for the Convention Against Torture review of Azerbaijan, their compliance, or in this case, failure to comply with their obligations under the Convention Against Torture. And we discussed, CFTJ submitted a report detailing the testimony taken from 30 returned POWs or repatriated POWs after they were detained in Azerbaijan and eventually sent back. And without fail, they were all the people that we took testimony from discussed how when a guard entered a room, they had to immediately say, Karabakh is Azerbaijan. And your whole life, when you've been, understood that you're connected to this land and your very existence is connected to this land, and this land is Armenian, to be forced to say something like that every time the guards came in was, you know, it was a means to humiliate them and denigrate them and just take everything from them that they know to be themselves and sort of just strip them of their identity completely. So yeah, that's just reminding me of the wording.
And Telly, you had some thoughts.
Yes. Yeah, so thank you. Steve, thanks for the overview on the ICJ case. You're absolutely spot on that a lot of the discussion in the case is based on the CERD, the Convention on All Forms, on the elimination of all forms of racial discrimination. And a lot of it is centered on hate speech coming out of Azeri officials. I do also want to mention that case is a case of first instance because it not only discusses the actions are not only hate speech, the actions are torture, civilian executions, summary executions, arbitrary detentions, on the basis of the fact that all victims against whom these crimes were committed were of ethnic or national origin Armenian, right? So that nexus between the actions that are in and of themselves atrocity crimes, right? We have crimes against humanity, torture, arbitrary detention. Those are international crimes. But the nexus that those crimes were only committed on the basis of the fact that the victims were of ethnic or national origin Armenian is the part that really hooks it on to the Racial Discrimination Convention. And it's not a novel theory, but it's certainly the first time that the ICJ is actually taking up the merits of a case on this basis. And it's going to be really interesting for all of us in the international community to follow along in this case, because Ukraine has very similar claims on the exact same convention against Russia. So there's only two cases going forward ever regarding violations of the CERD. One is Armenia v. Azerbaijan, and the other is Ukraine v. Russia, which obviously has huge implications for the international community.
Just to follow up on that real quick.
Please go ahead.
No talk. Aline's absolutely right. I'm really glad she clarified this point. I think it's so interesting in some way. It goes back to your earlier question, Doug, about sort of the role that these courts play in the larger conflict and in hopefully the resolution, which is that the ICJ is a court, but it's also a conflict resolution mechanism. And that's why what's been so important in a way, the center of gravity, at least in the news, has not been the merits, but has been the issuance of these provisional measures by the court, which play a political role. And so, as Colleen just said, this nexus is really clear when you read those judgments, not judgments, those exhortations, again, which have no enforcement behind them, but are so important when you have the court in December 2021 saying to Azerbaijan to take, quote, take all necessary measures to prevent the incitement and promotion of racial hatred and discrimination, including by its officials and public institutions, targeted persons of Armenian national or ethnic origin. And then later in November 2023, they say again that Azerbaijan must ensure that persons who remained in Nagorno-Karabakh after September 2023 or returned are free from the use of force or intimidation that may cause them to flee. So you see this direct connection, and the court is saying that the racial discrimination and the connection, that it's showing the direct connection between the ethnic cleansing that's recently occurred, the starvation, the torture, the war crimes. So we see the court again, as it always does, playing a legal but also a political role, which is extremely important and can remind us of another conflict where it's doing the same thing that is in the news, right?
Yeah, and Kelly, go ahead.
Yes, Steve, thank you so much for bringing up those provisional measures orders. I think it's so significant to think about the provisional measures order that the court issued in November 2023, the most recent provisional measures order. You mentioned it, but I just want to highlight how significant it is in one single case for the International Court of Justice to now issue three separate provisional measures orders, which is quite rare in the life of the ICJ. Obviously, you know, there's a risk of irreparable harm ongoing in this conflict that the court found that it was necessary to intervene on three separate occasions. And in that one of November 2023 that Steve just mentioned, the court actually took an additional step to not only put the binding legal obligation on Azerbaijan to keep all Armenians safe who remain in Nagorno-Karabakh after 19 September 2023, or to keep everyone safe and allow the return of those that wish to return. They also required Azerbaijan to report to the court what the progress was and what the status would be of actually following this provisional measures order, which is an extraordinary step that I can't remember the last time the court required a report back to the court on the progress of this provisional measures order. And it also speaks to the difficulty in getting one of these, you know, sort of an authoritarian regime to actually play by the rules of the rest of the international legal order. I mean, that's extraordinarily challenging for the ICJ. They don't have international courts martial that are going to go out and, you know, handcuff people that don't follow their provisional measures orders. But it's just interesting to think about how many different times they've actually tried to get Azerbaijan to behave and stop violating the CERD directly.
And Talin, it seems then there's two big sort of political messages coming out of here. First of all, the ICJ, and not just in this case, but in other cases, like, for instance, some of its preliminary, you know, decisions on, you know, Israel-Gaza, you know, for example, and that one immediately comes to mind, that the ICJ is becoming a bit more, flexing its muscles a little bit more. But the other one that really strikes me, you made this reference to the CERD, or, you know, a reminder, this, the Convention on the Elimination of Racial Discrimination, which, I mean, obviously is a treaty that's been out there for quite some time, but you hadn't heard it referenced international legal, international political discourse for quite some time, but it's sort of getting a much more visible profile in international law. This case, I guess one of my questions, is this the first case that has specifically been cited, you know, to the ICJ on this convention on the elimination of racial discrimination? Or is it, because I can't recall any others. So, you know, is this breaking new legal ground?
So the problem with bringing a case, so the quick answer is no, this isn't breaking new legal grounds in that it's not the first CERD case that's ever been brought before the ICJ. But I will say it's the first that's gone forward so far and has not been dismissed on jurisdictional grounds. The reason for that is that the CERD specifically requires a lot of negotiation between the parties before they can actually file in the ICJ. That was sort of the nail in the coffin for pretty much the only one I can remember to date is it was filed maybe 2 or 3 years ago by Qatar. Qatar filed a CERD claim against United Arab Emirates in the ICJ, and I believe it was dismissed on jurisdictional grounds because they did not negotiate between the parties before filing the case for the appropriate amount of time required by the convention. But in this case, Armenia sort of went through with ongoing negotiations. There were multiple note verbales between the parties. There were multiple diplomatic meetings, and sort of. It's a strange thing you have to do, but in order to sort of trigger jurisdiction before the court on the CERD specifically, every time you want to talk to the other party that you might sue in the future, you have to kind of say, I want to talk to you about the CERD. And that kind of, you know, is like you check that box that you tried to have that state versus state negotiation before getting to the jurisdiction of the court. And so I think Armenia and Azerbaijan had more than a year of ongoing negotiations, which then allowed them to get past those jurisdictional hurdles. But as Steve mentioned, we are actually in hearings. We're waiting for a decision from the court right now on Azerbaijan's objection to jurisdiction in this case. So it remains to be seen if the court will find that we should go forward on jurisdictional grounds.
When we come back, Armenia has taken legal action against Azerbaijan, claiming numerous violations of international law. What are the specific causes of action, and what impact might rulings be from these courts? Stay with us. This is the Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Maria Armudian. Armenia is under intense pressure to negotiate a permanent peace with Azerbaijan. How could this normalize and legitimize Azerbaijan's aggression? And what does it signal to aggressors internationally about the likelihood of punishment for this aggression? Doug Becker explores.
I'm Doug Becker. On today's show, we're talking about the conflict between Armenia and Azerbaijan, specifically Azerbaijan's aggression towards Armenians, the legal cases that would be violations of the Convention on the Elimination of Racial Discrimination, questions of hate speech, questions of whether or not Azerbaijan is committing genocide, or at least should there be an investigation into individuals committing genocide, torture, and other forms of international legal instruments. Our panel today is Tamara Voskanian. She is a co-founder of the Center for Truth and Justice, a nonprofit organization that documents atrocities and uses evidence to bring perpetrators to justice. Pauline Hittig, an international human rights advocate, it's focused on seeking accountability for war crimes and human rights violations and has been associated with the American University of Armenia, Yerevan State University, and the University of Michigan Law School. And Steve Swartbow, who is an associate professor of the practice on human rights, works for Human Rights Watch, and teaches at the University of Southern California. Tamara, I want to turn to you for this next question, because your organization, the Center for Truth and Justice, has asked for an investigation for violations of international humanitarian law and specifically of genocide. What are the campaigns that you're focusing on that specifically would trigger such an investigation?
So, as I mentioned earlier, in May 2021, the Azerbaijani Armed Forces initiated a military aggression into Armenia, and that's resulted in the illegal occupation of, you know, a certain portion of Armenian sovereign territory in various provinces of Armenia. And the argument, for which we have, of course, the testimony and evidence, is that Azerbaijan's leaderships at the highest levels have planned and instigated and ordered and directly implemented a state policy of genocide against ethnic Armenians through a campaign of forcible removal of at least 7,000 ethnic Armenians from Armenian territory by occupying the territory through unlawful military aggression and systematic killing of those ethnic Armenian civilians who refused to leave the territory, also forced disappearance of at least 200 ethnic Armenian civilians and POWs, and extrajudicial execution of a certain number of POWs captured since May 2021. And also, Armenians have been subjected to arbitrary detention, and there have been several hundred documented cases of torture and other inhumane acts against both ethnic Armenians and prisoners of war.
And what makes this particularly important ICC case then is this is irrespective of any assertions of sovereignty. I mean, whether or not it's in territory that gets recognized as Armenian, as Azerbaijani, as, you know, contested territory, none of that matters when you're talking about questions of ethnic cleansing and detentions and anybody being targeted specifically because of ethnicity. As we talked about in the first part, there's been all this legal discourse about sovereignty and who's responsible, you know, who has authority, jurisdiction over these cases. But genocide elevates beyond questions of jurisdiction. It's got this universal component that's attached to it. Is that part of that motivation? Talene, you want to respond to that?
Thank you for that question. Actually, it's important to note that the Republic of Armenia did decide to accede to the Rome Statute. It entered into force officially on February 2023, but in their accession documents, Armenia, in my personal opinion, very intelligently, actually made a note that their accession would track back to the date of May 10th, 2021. Why is that date so significant? Because that is the beginning of all of the events beginning that Tamara was discussing, right? So the jurisdiction very much does matter. There's territorial jurisdiction for state parties to the Rome Statute, but all of everything that we've discussed here today, both the incursions into the sovereign border of Armenia, incursions into the territorial integrity of Armenia, the forced displacement of 7,000 Armenian citizens inside their border, as well as the 19th September 2023 attacks in Nagorno-Karabakh, are all part of the same ongoing events that then trigger jurisdiction because, for example, the ethnically cleansed Nagorno-Karabakh Armenians went from Nagorno-Karabakh, which even if you want to argue all day that it's Azerbaijan or that it's Armenia or that it's an independent state, it's irrelevant because of the fact that there's now that nexus of jurisdiction into the Republic of Armenia, which is a state party to the Rome Statute. So jurisdiction does matter, but in this case, jurisdiction is satisfied because Armenia has acceded to the Rome Statute.
And Steve Swerdlo, one of the things that has kind of complicated, you know, potentially complicated some of these legal cases, is I know that Armenia and Azerbaijan have been negotiating over some sort of resolution. I'm actually not familiar with the details, but I know there's been negotiations between Armenia and Azerbaijan, negotiations that have opened the Armenian government up to quite a bit of criticism from their own population for being too complicit with Azerbaijan. First, is that a fair characterization? Secondly, what's motivating these negotiations?
What's motivated these negotiations is that Azerbaijan has, through force, subjected Armenia to such unrelenting abuse and pressure through violence, forced displacement, and you know it's negotiating while holding a gun to someone's head. And I'm not an expert on Armenian domestic politics, so other speakers might be better positioned to comment on whether or not Prime Minister Pashinyan has been, you know, sort of adroitly negotiating. I think that's extremely complicated, but one thing is clear is that President Aliyev seems to be achieving his objective of really destabilizing and demoralizing and humiliating large segments of the population, most directly the 120,000 Armenians that were forced to flee. Imagine the misery and the pressure that's been placed on Armenia. And amidst that, there are no signs that Azerbaijan is pulling back on its pressure to incur into the territory of Armenia. All this while supposedly, you know, litigating in good faith, you know, at the ICJ, it's preposterous. These are not circumstances under which I think peace process can really successfully occur. And what we've needed to see is Armenia's international partners being willing to step up. Now, just a few days ago, Doug, I might be bringing something else into the discussion, but just a few days ago, we saw the U.S. ambassador to Azerbaijan, not 6 months after a Senate hearing in which high-placed U.S. officials said that they would not countenance and they would not support ethnic cleansing by Azerbaijan, we have the U.S. ambassador to Azerbaijan visiting now Azerbaijan's newly recaptured territories in Nagorno-Karabakh and essentially celebrating the ethnic cleansing campaign, putting a fancy video on Twitter. And, you know, this was on top of the really tone-deaf, and I'm sorry to say it this way, press conference held by, for example, the renowned genocide scholar Samantha Power in her role as administrator of the U.S. Agency for International Development, who days after the September operations in 2023 was put on the spot and said, look, what does the U.S. government have to say about an ongoing, unfolding genocide? And so I think what we've seen really, Doug, is that, yes, the negotiations are proceeding. Armenia is in a lot of turmoil. Of course, there's a robust and democratic and vibrant and competitive political scene. We know that about Armenia, and thank God that Armenia is a democracy. But I would say the larger story to me, you know, is essentially the inertia, the impotence, whatever you want to say about the international community's response to Azerbaijan's growing assertiveness and this really key role that Azerbaijan is also playing with its oil, as it's always done, but now in the context of Ukraine. Azerbaijan is aiding and abetting Russia's laundering of oil. And really, Europe is saying, it's okay with us. As long as we get what we need from you, as long as we get more gas and oil, we will continue to sort of allow this terrible status quo to continue. And I think what is happening is Armenia is really suffering, and we need a more robust human rights response on all fronts. So that's why I think these court cases are so important. But absent real international pressure, absent targeted sanctions, absent a more consistent calling for the release of Armenian political prisoners in Azerbaijan, absent a more consistent release of Azerbaijani political prisoners in Azerbaijan, we're not going to see President Aliyev change his posture. He's just been reelected. In February, he said he got 92% of the vote. And as we sit here, Doug, making this recording, I think the statistics are that since November, he has arrested the 13th Azerbaijani journalist on corruption charges. So that's what we're dealing with. We're dealing with a government which is so used to throwing its weight around and violating international human rights commitments. And that's the environment in which peace negotiations are occurring, which is very problematic.
Absolutely. And this question about the legitimation of this aggression, we're going to circle back to. But first of all, you're listening to Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Doug Becker. We're talking about the legal cases that Armenia has against Azerbaijan in violations of the Convention on the Elimination of Racial Discrimination, of war crimes, violations of the Convention Against Torture, the Genocide Convention. And our guests today are Tamara Voskanian of the Center for Truth and Justice, Talin Hitik, previously of American University of Armenia, Yerevan State University, and University of Michigan Law School, and Steve Swerdlo of the University of Southern California. And Talin, you had a response to this question about negotiations and legitimation of Azerbaijan's aggression.
I'm really happy that we're having this discussion right now, because as it happens, I'm currently sitting in Washington, D.C., and throughout this whole past week, I've been a part of a delegation which has been meeting with State Department officials, DOE officials, members of Congress, to try to convince them to take more action, be more nuanced, to really understand the complexities of the issues between Armenia and Azerbaijan. And of course, from my point of view as an international human rights lawyer, to care about gross violations of human rights and to help us in seeking justice and accountability for those violations of international law. One thing that I found, to Steve's point about these ongoing negotiations and the position of someone like Aliyev, who literally has given up absolutely nothing and has gained four villages in the meantime from Armenia over this past month, what I've noticed on a whole, and I've been to three different State Department meetings over the last, just this past week, what I've noticed as a whole is it's almost as though Secretary Blinken or President Biden are looking for a Nobel Peace Prize to unfreeze a 30-year frozen conflict, which accomplished a ceasefire in the 90s and never a peace treaty, and is now on its way to finally being a peace treaty. And I'm hearing, these are my words, but the implication is, let's get to a peace treaty at all costs. So when I hear them say there's incredibly powerful, there's positive steps, the two sides are talking, there's powerful steps, we're so excited that Azerbaijan has agreed to the Almaty Protocol for the maps that we're going to use to, delimitate the borders. Armenia has agreed to give back four villages that were recognized as Azerbaijani in the Soviet times, which I don't necessarily disagree with. But we're getting to this point where we want to ink a peace deal at the cost of 120,000 indigenous ethnic Armenians who have lost their indigenous homeland. And when I ask the very obvious question, which is, what about the refugees? And what about their right to return home under international law? I get a lot of discomfort. I get a lot of discomfort in the rooms. And I'm not okay with that. I'm really, really not okay with that. And I'm certainly not going to celebrate a peace deal. And, even if Pashinyan signs it, even if Aliyev signs it, I'm personally never going to celebrate that if it means that we completely left off the table the lives and the right to return of indigenous ethnic Armenians who need to return home and need an ability to do that.
Tamara, I did want to ask then, in that context, is there support from the Armenian government for this petition or for this request from the ICC? Is there a sense that negotiations may not bring justice, but perhaps the ICC can?
No, I wouldn't say that there's no, organization or cooperation. But, it's not, CFTJ is entirely independent. And this was a decision that CFTJ would make no matter who's in power, no matter what the government's doing. We just, simply try to stay in our lane, document the evidence, use the evidence in the ways that we feel it might be the most effective or the ways that present themselves, really. We're still coming up with additional pathways to use the evidence, and we will continue to do that. Court cases are just one way, but it's it's going to operate regardless, and it's going to be necessary regardless of who the government is and what they're doing.
And Steve, I'd be remiss, especially since you were talking about the ways in which Azerbaijan is getting a kind of normalization, if not legitimation, of their aggression, that the one issue that keeps popping up is the irony of a state that's number one exports are fossil fuels, that they are going to apparently host the next climate change meetings. The idea that the international community is going to turn to Azerbaijan essentially never to raise these issues and instead focus on issues of climate change. As far as Aliyev and Azerbaijan is concerned, this is going to shift the attention away from this, and they see this as an opportunity to normalize the aggression.
Yes, I mean, this is a tried and true tactic of dictatorships of using often these high profile, often sports events, Eurovision. Azerbaijan is known for this as their specialty. But the confluence in a way here of, the track record of COP has not been so good with this. They were in Egypt, UAE. This has also become in a way their modus operandi of working with petro states. And I think I actually see this as an opportunity, a strategic opportunity for the human rights community to call attention to abuses in Azerbaijan, as well as the conflict and the abuses inflicted on Armenia. I think that activists like Jala, the daughter of Gubad Ibadoglu, a human rights activist herself. Jala Ibadoglu, who has been campaigning for the freedom of her father. He's an Azerbaijani economist and anti-corruption activist who was in prison when he went back to Azerbaijan to visit his mother. And she's been everywhere, pointing out the hypocrisy and just the moral failing of putting COP29 in Baku. But I think she's right, in signaling to us that we can use this as an opportunity to, dare I say, name and shame, right? I think that's a tactic that we have to use and we can use effectively. I do think that Azerbaijan has a history of, you talked about, Armenia, unfortunately having to capitulate, but you know what? We do see that dictatorships, as strong as they appear, they do crumble. They do make concessions when forced into a corner. I have no doubt that the intense pressure and scrutiny on Azerbaijan will cause them, I hope, to release further political prisoners. I think we just need to keep the pressure up. And one other thing, relating to the previous question about the negotiations, as a thought experiment, I mean, what if, I completely agree with what Talin was saying about just the wholly unsatisfactory state of affairs in these negotiations, but what if Azerbaijan was negotiating if additional pressure was being placed, if we had the commanders that were responsible for the war crimes, for the targeting of maternity wards in Stepanakert during the conflict, if those individuals were put on the global Magnitsky list, if those individuals knew their visas were denied, their assets were frozen, if we understood that the ICC was going to move forward, I think all of these things could have a cumulative and important effect. So in my mind, COP29, in a way, we should use it. We should use it for all it's worth. And I really hope that by that time, by November, we'll have made some progress and we'll already have seen the release of political prisoners in particular.
And a quick reminder, the Magnitsky Act is the way in which international actors, including the United States, can target individuals for sanctions. So it's something that's been used quite a bit vis-a-vis, against Russians that have committed aggression, a number of other actors. But Talin, you had a response to it as well.
Yeah, thank you so much for bringing up Magnitsky sanctions, Steve. That is absolutely something that I've brought up a lot, to the visible discomfort of State Department officials. But, this is part of that intellectual dishonesty, right? I mean, if you look at Magnitsky sanctions are specifically related to the US's actions, but I mean, let's also look at the hypocrisy of the European Union completely cutting off all of its, oil reserves from Russia, Germany being named and shamed for continuing to, you know, have Russian oil pipelines, and then all of a sudden to just turn around and go from one, you know, war criminal dictator to the other and say, well, we absolutely can't support Putin's oil, but, you know, our best friend is now Aliyev in Azerbaijan. And thank you so much, Azerbaijan, for rescuing the European Union's energy supply while we are fighting this horrible war of aggression in Ukraine. And that was frankly devastating to a lot of people who are following the ethnic cleansing and gross human rights violations and violations of international humanitarian law that took place in Nagorno-Karabakh against the ethnic Armenians. And I do hope that COP29 in Baku is an opportunity for the international community to sort of all eyes on Baku. And I would be remiss if I didn't specifically mention, Steve, thank you for bringing this up. Also, the political prisoners. There are 9 political prisoners in Baku right now that are former officials of the Republic of Nagorno-Karabakh. 3 of them are former heads of state, and they are still in prison in Baku since 19 September 2023. And the crime that they committed is being a part of the government of the Nagorno-Karabakh Republic, because if you live in this bubble of Azeri, of Azerbaijani, Orwellian doublespeak, you have to first establish, well, everyone that was in Nagorno-Karabakh was a quote-unquote separatist. The fact that they were there and they had their own government made them a quote-unquote terrorist. And now we can actually try them on trial for the crime of terrorism. So everyone that was simply an ethnic Armenian living in Nagorno-Karabakh is now a terrorist, and they are actually on criminal trial as we speak. Do we know what that trial looks like? No. Do we know who's representing them? No. But what I do know is that last year, the government of Azerbaijan stripped away bar membership from anyone who had ever been insulting to the government. And basically, you have to play this game of being totally kowtowing and be a total shill of the Azeri government in order to keep your bar membership and actually practice law in Azerbaijan. And so I can't imagine who they are that are the you know, the public defenders that are representing these Armenian officials, but it's a huge, huge issue. Will they be released by the time COP29 happens? I don't know, but if they're not, I certainly hope that the international community has a real serious highlight on them and their concern, and that the concern is really deeply expressed.
And we have about 90 seconds left, Tamara. I want to give you the last word here. What should we be looking for with respect to developments, you know, specifically in your case, you know, for the ICC and sort of broadly on this issue? What should we keep our eyes on?
We're going to be looking for some orders in the ICJ case. We're going to be hoping that an investigation will be launched by the ICC, and we can use, frankly, some friendly states' help there to get an investigation launched. So eventually we would want a referral for the investigation, and states or NGOs can submit communications just the way that CFTJ did to request that investigation take place. So we would encourage, you know, NGOs, states, any parties that can submit an ICC communication requesting the same investigation to do so, to urge the court to look into it. And I just want to highlight what Steve and Tallinn just said regarding the detainees. I'm so glad you brought that up, the political prisoners. And just kind of want to bring it all together that we know the way detainees are treated in Azerbaijan. We have evidence to support that they are being tortured, and confessions are being extracted from them by torture, and that those confessions are being used in courts to establish their convictions. And so this is all tied together. And we also know that that's why so many Armenians are, the campaign of ethnic cleansing is so effective. That's why over 120,000 Armenians have been displaced, and now more Armenians are being displaced in Armenia proper, is because Armenians know what awaits them if they are to be taken captive by Azerbaijan. They know the way that they're going to be treated. They know all the violations of laws that are going to take place. So that's why the campaigns have been so effective, and the hate and discrimination is the basis of all of it.
No, absolutely. I think what, you know, main takeaways from here, first of all, is from a perspective of international human rights law, it is both exciting and shocking the ways in which the Convention on the Elimination of Racial Discrimination is becoming more empowered as a result of this action. We wish, obviously, that these cases didn't have to be brought, but it is very important that these cases are, you know, are being developed, that the, you know, quite distinct possibility that genocide is unfolding once again in front of our eyes, a reminder that the phrase is never again. And if that means anything, we must speak up about genocide being committed anywhere around the world. Our panel today has been Tamara Voskanian. She's the co-founder of the Center for Truth and Justice. This is a nonprofit organization that documents atrocities, uses evidence to bring perpetrators to justice. And they have recently filed a request at the International Criminal Court for an investigation of genocide against Azerbaijan. Talin Hitik, an international human rights advocate, she's focused on seeking accountability for war crimes and human rights violations. She's worked as a legal officer at the Hague Conference on Private International Law, the Permanent Court of Arbitration, has served the Ministry of Justice of Armenia, specifically on European Court of Human Rights Litigation, and has served as professor of international human rights and humanitarian law at American University of Armenia, at Yerevan State University, and most recently as an academic affiliate at the University of Michigan Law School. And Steve Swerbo, he's an associate professor of the practice of human rights in the Department of Political Science and International Relations at the University of Southern California. He writes extensively as a human rights monitor for Human Rights Watch and specifically focuses on Central Asia and the Caucasus. Thank you all very much for sharing your time and your expertise.
Thank you so much, Doug.
Thank you, Doug.
Thanks for having us.
And that's it for today's program. Thank you for listening. The Scholar Circle is hosted by Doug Becker. Its managing producer is Ankina Agassian. Mahika Chechi is our assistant producer. Sed Dongre is our webmaster and assistant producer. Our archives are at scholarcircle.org, and our podcasts are on Apple and Google Podcasts and iTunes. Please follow us on @ScholarCircle or me @Armudian and join our Facebook page. I'm the founder, anchor, and occasional host, Maria Armudian.